Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is episode 64 of the Intercooler podcast, and we're talking about classic cars, or rather, what makes a car a classic? How do we know which modern cars are going to become classics? How do you define that term, classic? Andrew, we haven't done a great deal of prep for this one, but I suspect this is the sort of topic you can just riff on, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure I'll think of something to say. I think the point being is that, you know, old and classic are not synonyms.
Yeah.
Just because a car is old doesn't make it classic. And there are lots of cars that are old, which absolutely aren't classics. So, I'm sure I can think of some nonsense to spout on this subject. I have given a little bit of thought. I think there are certain things you can look for in a car that make it more likely than not to achieve classic status in the future. But I think very few of these things are guaranteed.
Okay, well, we'll find out what those are in a few minutes. First, we just need to do the now customary, the Intercooler app update. Subscriptions are rolling along very nicely indeed. They really are. So if you haven't downloaded it yet.
Blimey.
Do it now and see what you're missing out on. You can start your free trial. Just do it now. We've posted some really cool stuff, I think, this week. More from David Tuig. He's our sort of tame car engineer of just extraordinary stock. He is the bloke who engineered the Alpine A110, but quite apart from
that, you'd get it in there.
Well, that won't be the only mention for the A110 this episode. But he also led the development of the first Renault Zoe and the Nissan Qashqai. So he understands mass market and electric vehicle engineering as well as just about anybody, which means he's got this amazing insight. And every time he writes something for us, I learn something that I'd never heard of before.
Because sorry to interrupt, but also unlike, frankly, most engineers, he speaks human being as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
And it's just so easy. I mean, you know, the piece he posted for us in the last week is basically about a triangle. It's about three points in a car around which the entire car is designed. And if I've often thought, you know, how do you start? You know, you think, okay, I need a new car. What's the very first thing you do? Well, David's piece answers all that.
Yeah, you don't start with the front bumper and then the headlights and then the wheel arches.
Backwards from there.
You'll have to read the piece, but basically you start with the driver's heel, which is quite interesting. So that's on there now. Go download the app, start your free trial. You'll be able to look at it straight away. There's plenty more on there. We've posted just now, we're recording this on Friday, so we've just posted on the app about BMW announcing that it's coming back to the top tier of sports car racing.
Sort of exciting.
Yeah, it's slightly cryptic, wasn't it?
Well, it's a one-line Instagram post.
That's so 2021, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. It is. Yeah, it's just really. So, I mean, yeah. So if you haven't seen it, the one line Instagram post, it says something like, "We're back, Daytona 2023." But the significant thing being that there's a picture of the V12 LMR, the car that Williams produced, designed, and engineered, but was a BMW and won Le Mans in 1999. That's how we know it's not like another GT car or anything else. And Daytona means it'll have to be in the LMDH category, along with Porsche and Audi and others, because the LMH category, it's so confusing, isn't it? But that's the sort of slightly freer sort of supercar category, if you like, that Ferrari and Peugeot and Toyota are committed to. They don't race in America. They don't race in IMSA. And Daytona is IMSA. And the point being that an LMDH can run both in IMSA and the World Endurance Championship, but an LMH can only run in the World Endurance Championship. So BMW are obviously chosen, like, you know, like Porsche and like Audi, the series, if that's the right word, formula, don't know, that allows them to race the thing wherever they want to, which strikes me as being eminently sensible.
Yeah, so they haven't said that they're coming back to Le Mans, but
they will.
They just would, won't they? Surely.
Yeah, I mean, well, given that the photograph that they use to illustrate this point is the only BMW ever to have won Le Mans, it would be a bit of a red herring, wouldn't it, if it turned out to be Le Mans turned out to be not part of that. And also, you know, they're just not going to say, you know, Audi, Porsche, you know, your closest, most deadly rival. Just help yourself to the world's greatest sports car race. It's just, I just can't see it happening.
Mm. Yeah, well,
it doesn't anyway.
Turns out to be true. I've thought it's BMW's position in international motorsport has been slightly odd for a while since it quit Formula One. What, 15 years ago or something?
Yeah.
Mm, I mean, not quite 15, it's 13 years ago or something. They haven't had a real top-flight racing programme. But and actually, the M8 in GTE, did that ever really make much sense to anyone?
It did okay, I think, in IMSA. I mean, I think it did some stuff on the other side of the water, but it certainly didn't do anything over here. And, you know, and its WEC programme, I think it did two seasons. I think it did like 18 and 19. I think wasn't as successful as I hoped it was going to be. So they just canned it. And actually, if you look back, and I'm generalising furiously, and there would be some great BMW racing cars, and I certainly wouldn't ever see it tonight. But if you look back, I mean, you know, what really, really major championships in any form of motor racing has BMW won? I mean, we think of them as this great sporting brand, and it is. But it seems that they sort of come along and they have a look, and then if they don't do well fairly quickly, then they go away again. Maybe that's unfair. I don't know. But, you know, their Formula E program didn't last very long. Their recent WEC program didn't last very long. And I just hope that, you know, with an LMDH, I mean, the point is that, you know, because you have, you know, only a choice of four chassis, you have to have a spec hybrid system, all your dimensions are chosen for you, you've got a fixed power output, you've got a fixed downforce to drag ratio, fixed weight, all that sort of stuff. You know, the point being is that it's going to be really affordable. And so hopefully that will mean that they choose to hang around because, you know, the world's just a better place. You know, the more manufacturers are in there doing it, and particularly the more manufacturers like BMW, who we all love and want to see do well.
Yeah, yeah, you're quite right. They don't have that glittering heritage like even a Mercedes-Benz, do they, or an Audi?
Or a Porsche. You look at all their rivals. You even think of Jaguar. You know, with all those Le Mans wins, BMW hasn't got any of that. It's kind of like a. It's not, but you know, another brand you could level a similar sort of thing at is Lamborghini. You know, Lamborghini has, you know, they've got a very active GT3 program and have had so for a long time. But they've never won anything big, you know. And, you know, they've done engine supply jobs in Formula One and that sort of thing. But none of it's ever really come to anything. And it's interesting. I just really hope that they're not just going to come back. And if it looks a bit hard, run away again. Come back and stay. Commit. You know, it's not going to cost them much money compared to, you know, Formula One or anything else they might be doing or have done in the past. And just really make a mark. There you go.
Go and win Le Mans for the second time. That'll make a big difference.
That'd be cool. I'd love to see BMW win Le Mans.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Genuinely, it'd be very, very cool.
So before we move on to classic cars, we have just published on the app a TI Super podcast. Now, TI Super podcasts are for app subscribers only, and they're guest-based. So whereas this main podcast is just Andrew and me talking nonsense at one another, on the TI Super podcast, we get guests on board.
Who actually know what they're talking about.
Who know what they're talking about. And this latest one is with David Pook, who's the former JLR chassis engineer, who's now modifying Alpine A110s, there you go, another mention, under his company, Life 110. I'll play a few minutes for you now.
More recently, you've been doing some fun stuff with Alpine A110s. You own one, and you've been trying to make that as good as you can as well. You've taken one of very few five-star road test cars and set out to try and find ways to make it better. That's an interesting approach, isn't it?
Yeah. I remember when I first thought, suggested to people that I was going to do it, and they're like, "Are you mad? You know, it's, have you read the reviews? What are you actually going to do? There's nothing left to do." And then, you know, that's never true. Nothing's perfect. And, you know, that car, well, the reason I own that car is because, one, I wanted to do something for myself and get out of the corporate world. And as part of doing that, the Alpine A110 had, if I'm being honest, had a little bit passed me by when it was first announced. And, you know, because I was at Goodwood at Festival of Speed with Project 8 and when the Alpine A110 was there, and I didn't give it a second look, you know. So, yes, I was busy. But and it was when the reviews came out and I started to kind of like have the interest, because it was, the reviews were five star, but also it was talk of it being a bit different. And I remember when I was having a chat with someone and they said, I've just weighed it. And it was like 1,100 kilos. And I thought I was kind of like slightly dumbfounded coming from JLR world, where we were doing Project 8 and you'd weigh like a four-seater Project 8 at nearly 1,800 kilos. And to have an 1,100 kilo sports car was completely and utterly new. And I became hooked into how have they done that, you know, and what does it mean when something is that light? I don't have the experience of a car that light. What does it mean? What have they done? So I, without driving it, I bought one. I got I got to the point where my brain says, well, you have to have it, you know, you have to learn about this car, you have to understand it, it's totally different. So and you've read the reviews. So my mindset was, I'm not going to hate it. If I drive it and there's things I don't like, I'm going to buy it anyway. So I just bought it. And the first time I drove it was when I drove off after just, you know, parting with the money. And typically, before I got home, I was like, well, I wonder if what would happen if I was to just do this, you know. And you begin to analyse. I guess it's part of one of the problems with the job is that you begin to analyze immediately rather than just enjoying, you know. So you're like, oh, well, this is how the steering behaves and it could do that better and it does this. And what if it did that instead? You know, so the brain starts analyzing. And, you know, I just thought, well, actually, yes, it's a five-star car for reasons X, Y, Z, but it's still not, you know, perfect. And there are things that I'd, for me, like to change, and you could call better, but it's just, you know, in the end it's different. And at the same time, I wanted to explore kind of social media a bit more in terms of what, and I thought, well, I've got this car, let's see how the fact that it's unique and different, would a social media experiment, you know, engage with people. And that's where it started from, really.
Obviously, talking about Alpines is my favourite thing to do. And I'm going to talk about Alpines with the bloke who owns one. So, yeah, we did do a little bit of that. But we also made sure that we spoke about chassis engineering, what it means, what the process is, how he got into that line of work. So it's an interesting listen, and you'll find it on the app now. So go and have a look. Now, A110s, I think that's a reasonable segue into classic cars, because will the A110 be a future classic? I mean, yes, surely.
Yeah, Yeah, it will be. I think it ticks enough boxes. Yeah, no, it will be. Yeah.
Okay. So we've said already that a classic car is not just an old car. We need to define it a little bit more specifically. Now, in the last couple of weeks, the Historic Classic Vehicles Alliance has sort of launched in the interests of the classic car industry. And I was reading up about it this morning. It defines a classic car as being aged 15 to 30 years old.
What?
Older cars than that are historic cars. And it just amuses me that the driver of an early Ford Focus is a classic car owner without realising it. I mean, there must be plenty of people out there. So I think we need a more specific definition than that, don't we?
We absolutely do. Well, I mean, do we need a definition? Or, well, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? Is it, you know, it's like, you know, the British versus the American constitutions. Do you actually need one written down? Or do you just, you know, trust to your values and know what it is when you see it? And I think you could tie yourself in knots if you try to determine what, you know, precise qualifications. And if you tick one or all of those or most of those things, then therefore that makes you a classic car. Because there will always be exceptions. There will always be just quirky cars that should be on it, and probably some that, you know, objectively you look at and think probably should be on it but aren't. So, you know, I think that there are a number of things that a car can be which makes it much more likely to be a classic car. Allow me to expand
Go on.
A little bit. And I'm not doing this in any particular order, okay? But if a car is rare, that makes it more likely that they'll become a classic car. Now, some cars are deservedly rare because they're terrible. If a car is beautiful, that makes it more likely to become a classic car because that provides an element of appeal to a certain constituency of punter. If a car is fun to drive, I think that makes it much more likely to become a classic car. And I don't really think I need to explain the reasons for that. If the car is important in some way, I think that makes it much more likely to become a classic car. If the car has some kind of competition history, that makes it massively more likely to be a classic car, because that conveys upon it an authenticity which you don't get anywhere else. If it is technologically interesting, if there's something on it which maybe hadn't been done before, maybe it didn't even happen again afterwards. Something like, I don't know, an NSU Row 80, you know, the first rotary engine car. You know, that's a very interesting, innovative car. And I think anybody would tell you that that was a classic car. And of course, you don't have to have all those things, because basically, if you want a car that ticked all those, but I'm not even sure there is a car that ticks all of those boxes. There probably is somewhere. Maybe someone will let us know what it is. But you need some or more of all of the above. You know, rare, beautiful, interesting, fun, technologically interesting, motorsport competition. And if you get enough of those together, then, you know, the more of them you can get together, the more likely it is that what you'll be looking at is a classic car. And if you don't tick any of those boxes, what you actually have is just an old car.
Yeah, that's right. So if you tick all those boxes, you've got a 250 GTO or something.
Well, 250 GTO, I thought 250 GTO. And then I thought to myself, technologically, not very interesting. There's nothing particularly technical. A 250 GTO was a brilliantly realised piece of really quite old technology. There was nothing on it. I mean, it had a live rear axle. V12 engines had been around for a long time. You know, there wasn't anything clever in the chassis. It was just brilliantly done. So even a 250 GTO, which is kind of like, you know, the poster car for all this sort of thing, despite its beauty and its rarity and, you know, brand, that's another thing. It's got to come from a, you know, it helps, doesn't it, if it's a Ferrari rather than a Wartburg. Yeah, if it was,
that's right, yes. Yeah.
If so it was a Wartburg the more 250 boxes... GTO, it probably wouldn't be quite as classic as as a Ferrari. So that's another thing. Sorry.
But I suppose, yeah, the more boxes you tick, the more... Well, ultimately, the more valuable that car will become one day. That's probably that there'll be a direct correlation there, won't it, between the number of boxes ticked and the value of that car. I think that's probably beyond doubt. But It's such a fuzzy definition. Something like an E30 325i. Is that a classic car?
To me, it is. To me, it is. Because, okay, I mean, how does that make you think? You think E30 325i. I just get warm feelings about it. I want to drive one. If I saw one parked in the street, I would cross the street and go and make sure it didn't have an automatic gearbox in it. And that to me is, okay, maybe that's the criteria. Would you cross the street to go and look at it? I don't know. I think some kind of measure like that is probably as reliable, probably more reliable than, you know, trying to come up with all these different criterias and coming up with some magic formula of all of them, which somehow qualifies a car. You know, how does it make you feel? You're walking down, you know, your high street and you suddenly see, I just would. And in fact, I do all the time. There was, a 323i that was parked in my local village the other day. And it was parked a bit off the street, and I just saw it out the corner of my eye because it was that very particular BMW orange cut colour. And I just found myself doing that and just going and gawping at it. And it wasn't a valuable car, and it was pretty scruffy, and there were bits falling off it. But I just love the idea that somebody was still out there using that sort of thing. So yeah, I just think you can tie yourself in knots trying to define it.
We should point out that this episode idea was suggested by a reader.
Yes, hang on. I'll even tell you who the reader was. Victor, forgive me, Victor, if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. Victor Uldbeik. He goes on Instagram under the handle of Not a Bright Boy. Really, sure he is, because he's had an excellent idea. And he said, I've mentioned the potential theme in a question best broadly defined as what makes a car a classic? Are there certain traits in play, or is it simply down to being brilliant or rare? And then he says, there are shooting brakes that would certainly fit in. Aston Martin GT5 shooting brake, among others. But so thank you, Victor. Really appreciate the idea. And if any of you guys have any ideas or things you'd like us to talk about, just get in touch. Get in touch through the Instagram site. Send us an idea, and if it's half good, we'll do it.
Yeah, we will. Somebody suggested one to me, and I like the idea, and I think we're going to do it next week. So yeah, we do read these, and we do them if we like the ideas. So back to classic cars. There's a real movement around the car your dad drove at the moment, isn't there?
Yes.
So Top Gear did that wonderful episode a couple of months ago. And we see things like the Haggerty Festival of the Unexceptional. And there's also the new museum, the Great British Car Journey, in Derbyshire, isn't it? People do seem to be taking the time just to pause and remember the very normal cars that used to be around in our youth.
But are they
classics? Are they classics?
So I'm doing it again this year. I judged the Festival of the Unexceptional last year, and I'm looking forward to doing it again this year. And the winner was a blue Morris Marina Estate base spec. So at the back of the car, there was this massive rubber bung where the rear windscreen wiper would have gone if you could have afforded a rear windscreen wiper. and I'm about to completely contradict myself, because if I saw that car on the street, I would absolutely cross the road and go and look at it. But I cannot, with my hand on my heart, tell you that a base spec 1.3 Morris Marina Estate is any kind of classic car, because it clearly isn't. I think another way of perhaps judging it is, was it a good car when it was new? I mean, I don't think I can think of many cars which people regarded as rubbish when they were new, which are now regarded as being classic cars. Maybe there are.
That's an interesting point. So back to the Haggerty thing, you've judged it. What on earth is the criteria for judging what the winner of the Festival of the Unexceptional is?
Again,
is it just a gut feeling?
It's exactly what we're talking about here. I think it is a gut feeling. And again, you know, I'd hate to try and put down on paper what makes a car quite so exceptionally unexceptional. Because it's just how does it make you feel? Does it make you smile? And part of that is tied up in your own personal experiences, isn't it? You know, I used to, When I was a young lad, shall we say, I used to have a thing about Austin Allegra's as square steering wheels, because for a couple of years they had these things called Cortex steering wheels, and they were okay. They were round off the other, but they were basically square steering wheels. And I just thought this was such an insane idea. Every time I saw an Allegra, wherever I was, whatever I was, I had to go and see whether it had a square steering wheel or not. And now, if I see a Cortex Allegra, now that just makes me happy. I just think it's funny. But I don't think that an Allegro with a square steering wheel is a classic car. Maybe we just tie ourselves in knots over it. I don't know.
Mm. I think we need a term, a catch-all term, for these older cars that we all admire somehow or are charmed by when we see them, but which are clearly not classic cars.
Well, they're charming cars. That's a sort of rubbish cars. Term, isn't it?
We need something because... Just because they're old, it doesn't mean they're classics, but we still admire them and like them and appreciate them.
But it doesn't, exactly. It doesn't mean, just because they're not classics doesn't mean we don't like them.
Mm. God, it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's really interesting, too.
So I've never owned a classic car. Not by our definition, at least. The HCVA will tell you that I've owned a couple. But never a proper classic car. Let's just pretend I've got 10 grand and I want my first classic car. I'm not a spanner, or I don't know how to use a spanner at least. So I don't want it to let me down every drive. I don't want to be underneath it every weekend. Where should I stick my money? I want something sporting, something that will be fun to drive, but it needs to have a distinctly classic car flavour. So it needs to feel very different to a modern performance car.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it. You could go and get, like in your position, I would go and get an old hatchback. Go and get yourself, 10 grand. I know this because I've done it myself. I go and get a 205 GTI, something like that, if you get a, the 205 GTI came out, I think, the back end of 1984. So they are, what does that make them now? 27 years old? Or older than that, go and get a Mark II Golf. Because I think if you don't go down that road, or you could go and get a, you could probably get a, I don't know what kind of E30 10 grand buys you, but it'll certainly buy you something. Because if you don't go down that road, then you get into those, slightly rubbish British sports cars. You get into Triumph Spitfires and MGBs and that sort of thing. And, it's an early MGB is actually a really, really lovely thing. But by the time they become a bit bloated and they've got the rubber bumpers and, all that sort of thing, to me, a lot of their charm had gone on. And I apologise if I'm upsetting MGB owners listening to this. So I think if you wanted to go and do that, we're almost in sort of, the MX5, let's not forget, the MX5 is 30 years old now, isn't it? Yeah, and actually, when I said the 205 GTI was 27 years old, I meant it's 37 years old, isn't it? So it's, these things are knocking on a bit now. And because I'm so old, I think, when I started doing this job, I was testing brand new 205 GTIs. I don't think of them in my head as being classics because, to me, there was a time when these were, when these were new cars. When I started in this job, you were three. So it's, so we have different perspectives. I think at the moment, if you can extend your budget beyond that, I think if I could have one classic car, a do-everything classic car, so you want it to be reliable, you want it to be great fun to drive, you want to be able to pile your kids into it, and you want to be able to do a distance. So these are none of the cars that I've got, because all my cars are, A, quite rubbish, but B, do very different jobs. But if I was going to have one car, I'd go and get, and I don't know what you pay for it, but probably not that much, a 1960s Alfa Giulia Saloon.
Oh, interesting.
Because they were so advanced when they were new. These are cars built in the early 60s, which had 5-speed gearboxes, twin cam engines, disc brakes all round, you go and look at the whatever kind of Ford Anglia or Escort you could get at the same time. And so, which means that today they're just superb to drive. You can't be unhappy in driving one of those at the same time. It's just not possible. You have that fabulous twin cam engine. They're very practical. You can get loads of space in them. And, in the interior, they're so they're so Italian and quirky, but they're also, you know, they're not mad. They're not, they don't just, you know, unlike the, you know, the sort of the Alphas that they started producing in the late 70s and the early 80s, which were just kind of different for the sake of being different and just ended up being infuriating. These are just really, really cool cars. And if you had, you know, a 1.6 Giulia Super, brilliant. 1.3 Giulia Super, doesn't matter. And also, the other thing is, as with all classic cars, you have to know that you've got a decent supply of parts, because if you think you damage it at all, you break anything, you're never going to be able to replace it, and it's going to, you know, put the car off the road, then that's no fun. And with cars like that, there are just bits everywhere. Because there are so many on the road, because there are so many, frankly, racing, there are so many people whose business it is to look after those cars, you'll always be able to get bits. And so, they're quite affordable. They're fantastic fun. And you'll just feel like $1 million every time you get in it. So that's, you know, that's where I would, you know, if I could have one affordable classic car, that's what I'd have.
Good shout. Okay, well, just to sort of round things up, should we try and define, or not define, we don't have to define it, but just think about what exactly the appeal of a classic car is. Would you choose to run one daily, or does that defeat the point?
Some people do, and I really admire them for doing it. But to me, no, I never would. So I have a mad brother who goes off and does things in old cars, and he does events all over Europe, particularly in places like Italy and Austria. And the strange thing to me is what he enjoys at least as much as the event is the getting there and getting back. So he just spends days sitting on motorways in old cars, rattling along, not going very fast. And to me, I don't understand the appeal of that. I would love to have a car like that once I'd arrived. But if all you're going to do, because I don't really regard sitting on a motorway as driving, is sitting on a motorway, I'd much rather sit in something that was quiet and comfortable and could keep me entertained. I don't want to sit there thinking, I'm doing with this car something it was never designed to do, because these sorts of roads didn't exist when it was built, and I'm probably stressing it a bit and constantly watching the gauges and fretting about this, that and the other, and thinking all the miles I'm putting on it, which, you know, would otherwise have been miles I could have spent enjoying myself in it, and so on and so forth. What was your question? I've completely lost my train of thought.
Well, there was a two-part question. You've answered the second part, but the first part was, what exactly is the appeal of a classic car?
Okay. Oh, you asked me about daily driver. Yeah, so no, I wouldn't daily drive a classic car. I think the appeal of the classic car is only going to become more accentuated, because, you know, I think we have seen, haven't we? You know, and there are endless examples of it, from, you know, the slow death of the manual gearbox, the adoption of electric power steering, you know, very shortly the worldwide adoption of electric powertrains. You know, all the things that we find charming in cars, normally aspirated engines, rear wheel drive, all this sort of stuff, it's all going. And so, you know, when I started doing the job, there were classic cars, but they weren't massively different to the cars that I was driving in my day job, because they were still usually, you know, they had the engine at that end, and they were driven at that end, and they had manual gears, and they had normally aspirated, and it didn't matter whether you're talking about, you know, a 1980s car or a 1950s car, they all had that sort of configuration. That's all changing now. And I think what a classic car has to do, and the reason that we love them, is they get you involved. And I've said this before on this podcast, and it's an analogy that I like, but I probably do overuse it. But it puts you on the stage and in the action, rather than in the stalls watching a show. And to me, that's what it's all about, because if you're in a car and, you know, you're having to manage its rather rubbish power band, and you're having to change gear all the time, and the steering isn't necessarily that precise, and you're thinking about not overheating the brakes, and you're balancing, and it hasn't got that much going on, there's just all this stuff. And we love driving. And so the more driving that a car allows you to do, rather than just sitting there going, the more fun it's going to be, as long as its responses are pure and clean and reliable. And that's, you know, that's what makes great cars, whatever their age. And so I think really that's it. I mean, to me, I know other people have different criteria. You know, I mean, things like, you know, a Ferrari 250 California, you know, long wheelbase, beautiful car. I suspect not great to drive. I suspect a bit of an old boat. But people love those things and pay bazillions for them, because they are such extraordinarily beautiful cars. I mean, that doesn't do it for me. I'm so much more interested in what a car is like to drive than what it is to look at. And so for me, and it is a very personal thing, and everybody's criteria is different, there's absolutely no right or wrong in it. To me, it ultimately comes down to how involved does it make me, because it is only through that involvement that I derive the fun. And if you're not driving a classic car for fun, what are you doing in it?
Yeah, well, there you go. That's it, isn't it? That is the appeal of a classic car.
Well, it is to me.
No, well, yeah, I think I see it the same way. I quite agree. It's not about looking at these things. That's not what I'm interested in. I like driving them. And the appeal of a classic car from a driving point of view is kind of eternal. It's ageless. It's timeless. And that's why this resto mod thing is really kicking off, because although these cars are re-engineered and they have more of the durability and so on of a modern car, they still feel small. They don't feel like they've got too much grip. They still have unassisted or hydraulic power steering. They still have manual boxes and NA engines. And you still operate them and drive them the way you would a classic car.
And so they're still evolving.
They're still evolving to drive, and they're not so bonkers fast generally that you're in license losing territory before you know it. So that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, something like an Alphaholics, that could be a classic car because it is based on a 60s Alpha, isn't it? It just happens to have been sort of reworked a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, they are, you know, they're wonderful things, I'm sure, but they're also massively expensive. But, you know, if somebody were to just do, you know, something like that Giulia I was talking about, but had just gone through it sufficiently just to make sure that, you know, it had completely modern car reliability, and maybe one or two, you know, little creature comforts, just those that would encourage you to drive the car more. So, you know, maybe if you could sneak some aircon in there, you might want to take it out on a sunny, you know, when it's a really hot day in the summer, when otherwise you might not. You know, and maybe you could play a song or two in it if you had to go and do a long journey, that sort of thing. So we can now do old cars with the benefit of hindsight. And so you can have both things. You can have modern car reliability and you can have old car charm, and you can put the two together and they are not mutually exclusive objectives. And to me, I find that extremely appealing and interesting. And clearly we're going to see a huge amount more of it.
Mm. Yeah, we definitely are. Okay, so which would you love to own more than any other?
Well, I mean, I always answer this question the same way. It's an F40, which is a silly answer, really, because I don't know what I'd do with an F40. I really don't. You know, and I've made this mistake so many times in the past. I've had so many cars which I've bought because I just really, really like the idea of having one. And then it just sits in my shed and I don't do anything with it, and then its role in my life becomes degraded to one where literally its only function is to make me feel guilty about not using it. And an F40 would undoubtedly do that. It would sit there for months because, you know, but the way our lives are configured, Dan, you know, as well as I do, particularly with this app, which is taking most of our waking hours, there just isn't the time to go off and really, really, you know, something like an F40, it's a car. You need to know exactly where you're going. Where you're going has to be exactly right for that kind of car. You know, you have to know exactly where it's going to stay once you get there. And you have to plan it out almost like a military campaign, or else at best it's going to be a disappointing experience because it's going to be frustrated because you can't use the car properly. Or at worst, you're going to sit there thinking, you know, I wish I'd taken the, you know, the modern 911 or whatever, you know, your daily driver might be. But then again,
it's an F40.
It was briefly supplanted by a LaFerrari. When I drove the LaFerrari, I suddenly thought to myself, "Blimey, is this the car that I actually replaces the F40 as the greatest road car of my experience?" And it did briefly, but now I sort of, you know, normal service has been resumed, and I just, there is something so pure and animalistic. And it's not because it's fast, because by modern standards, frankly, it's not that fast. But there is nothing that gets you closer to the sensations of driving than an F40. And I just feel like a sort of a small giddy child every time I even think of them. And, you know, even though I've been very lucky to have driven a few, it never goes away. And that's the other thing, you know, the novelty of an F40 would never, ever wear off. It's never going to be normal. You're never going to think, look at the F40 and think, oh, do you know, I've just done that a bit too much. I'm not going to bother with that for a bit. You know, you're always going to want to drive it. And that's another thing with classic cars. Do you always want to go and drive it? And if you do, then it's a classic.
There we go. Yeah, that's a pretty good definition. We've just bought a house and it's a proper renovation. So that's just, we're just pouring our money into that at the moment. But at some point, I'm determined that I will own my first proper classic car. It's not going to happen anytime soon, but for a, if you love cars and love driving, it's just such a big part of the whole experience, isn't it?
So what road are you thinking about going down?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not even thinking about it because it's too far off. But I'd also need somewhere to store it. I don't want it sitting on a driveway outside in the weather.
Depending on
the car, I suppose. But
and the other thing, and again, I speak from having made my own mistakes. You know, storing cars is absolutely fine, but if you don't store them really pretty close by, you still end up not using them because it just, you know, if it takes you half an hour to get there and half an hour to get back, that's basically put an hour onto your journey in the car. And if you were only going to drive it for a couple of hours, that's 50% more time spent just getting to it and back, and you just won't use it. I mean, when I lived in London, I had exactly the same thing as you. I had something and I didn't want it set outside the house because I was worried about it rotting and I was worried about it getting damaged. And so I stuck it under a tower block somewhere about 40 minutes away. And literally, I used to go and see it just to make sure it's still there. And that's no way to end a nice old car, is it?
No. Yeah, so I'm not going to do it anytime soon because my life isn't sort of configured in the right way at the moment, but it will happen. It will happen at some point because it's just such an antidote to driving a modern car, to commuting. You know, it's proper driving, not the driving that most people will think of when they hear that term.
I can see you and your other half in a step front Giulia Sprint GT 1965 Giulia Coupe. Go and have a look at it. Basically it's a GTA without, you know, it's an affordable GTA.
Oh, I'd love one. I'd love one. That is exactly the kind of classic car that I'm into. A little sports coupe, rear drive, good snorty engine. Yeah, I love it.
Dickie Meaden used to own one, and I've driven a few, and they're just... In fact, I went to see one once, and I decided before I saw it that I was going to buy it. And the bloke couldn't have been more helpful, and the car was absolutely lovely. In fact, he was so helpful. He had it in a garage with had a pit underneath it. And so I said, well, can I just go down the pit and look underneath? He said, yes, of course. And he gave me a torch. And then I discovered the car was completely rotten.
Oh. Ah. Oops.
So I didn't buy it in the end. But something like that. Yeah. Oh, God. Now I want one.
Yeah. Well, that's very, very high up my list, I have to say.
Yeah. Good.
All right. Good. Well, let's leave that one there. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Go and download the app. Just search the Intercooler on whichever app store you use. Start your free trial. It's going really well. So thank you, everybody, who has downloaded, subscribed, contributed in the comments. We're having a great time. And there's plenty more to come.
And thank you to all our contributors who've have really submitted some absolutely terrific stuff for us. And as I said before, what makes us pretty really happy about the fact that it is going well at the moment is it just means we're going to be able to keep on doing it.
Good stuff. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm
I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.